Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays a significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest is someone who has played key leadership role at Intel Corporation in developing the three biggest changes in transistor technology over the past decades. We are speaking with member of United States National Academy of Engineering, Intel Senior Fellow and Director of Transistor Technology and Integration, Dr. Tahir Ghani. Dr. Tahir Ghani is a senior fellow and director of Process Pathfinding Program at Intel Corporation. He received his PhD in electrical engineering from Stanford University in 1994. Since joining Intel in 1994, he has led the teams responsible for developing some of the most significant changes in semiconductor industry and implementing them into mainstream CMOS manufacturing. These include initial strained silicon transistors for 90 nanometer node, high-k metal gate transistors for 45 nanometer node, and FinFET transistors for 22 nanometer node. He currently leads Intel's pathfinding program with focus on technology definition, evaluation of new process innovations, and demonstrating their early viability for technologies beyond 2025. His contributions have been recognized by many awards, including 2008 SEMI Award for North America for the development of strained silicon technology, the 2008 EDN Innovator of the Year Award, 2012 SEMI Award for North America for the development of high-k metal gate transistor technology, and 2015 SEMI Award North America for bulk CMOS FinFET production. Tahir received 2012 IEEE Junichi Nishizawa Medal for sustained leadership in developing innovative transistor technologies for advanced logic products. He has served on the IEDM committee from 2004 to 2013 and was the technical program chair in 2012 and general chair in 2013. Tahir is a fellow of the IEEE and was elected to the United States National Academy of Engineering in 2015. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm fine. I will go back and start from the very beginning, and that starts with your childhood. So how was it? If you can share anything about your school life. So please go ahead.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share my life experiences with you and your audience. I was born and raised in Pakistan. City. It is a fairly big city. It's Lahore, with the population now currently between 10 and 15 million people. I grew up in a typical middle class family. My father was working in federal public service, and my mother was a homemaker. And I had one younger sister. So it's fairly small family by Pakistani standards. I went to high school, which was administered by missionaries, which provided me with a solid background in the fundamentals. So from that standpoint, I thought I got a really good elementary and middle school and high school education. On personal side, I fell actually in love with physics when I was introduced to it in high school. And I developed a strong desire to become a theoretical physicist. So during the course of my high school years, I had a strong desire that I would specialize and become a professional physicist. But as you may know, many of us who are from typical middle-class families in some continent, my father had a strong objection to it. And primarily due to its limited job prospects within Pakistan. So finally, you know, we talked about it and had strong conversations, many strong conversations. And I finally settled for applying to the electrical engineering program at the University of Engineering and Technology, which is commonly known as UET in Pakistan, which is the oldest school as far as the public engineering institutions are concerned in Pakistan.
Great. You know that most of the, I would say, the device specialists, they have a fondness for maybe for physics first, then math, and then chemistry. I think it goes that way, and it matches really well. And what you just shared, I'm pretty sure that many of our audiences from South Asia will be able to relate to that. But here you are. So let's talk about your undergraduate or college life in University of Engineering and Technology.
You know, I submitted my admission papers at UET at the time, not being really excited at the time about doing engineering. It was a good sort of a trade-off between the practical aspects, and I thought that electrical engineering would be the best among the engineerings, which would be more mathematical and also be more relevant as far as the modern physics is concerned. And that was my primary motivation for selecting electrical engineering as my major. You know, when I joined the engineering university at that time, the university was very active politically. And so that means that in subcontinent, that means that, you know, it means that there is a lot of activities which lead to a potentially a delay in graduation. As a result, the 4 years graduation really took closer to 4.5 to 5 years for us to graduate. My experience at the engineering university was, overall, I would say it was positive, in the sense that, you know, for the first time, I got to share my experiences with my classmates who belong to a very different social classes. You had people all over who came from villages. You also had other class people who came who were very urbanized, and people with all sorts of belief systems. And so from personal standpoint, I think it was a very rich experience. I also learned that my understanding of what EE would like would be like was actually very limited. You know, EE is a very vast field that I discovered, which can be very mathematical or it can be very physics oriented. So it basically covers a wide range of disciplines, and you know, which basically I discovered was actually to my liking. You know, when I graduated, my favorite courses really were around communication theory and signal processing during my undergraduate years. I think part of it was that they were abstract. They were also very, I found them very satisfying, and they were taught very well. Unfortunately, during those years, there wasn't much device physics work going on as far as the teaching of undergraduate teaching is concerned at the university. And I did not experience that component. When I graduated at that time, I was fairly certain that I would specialize in communications and signal processing. You know, I graduated, I did well academically at the university. And during my final year, I had decided already that instead of working, I would directly apply to graduate schools in the United States. And so I think I did decide in the end to attend Stanford University with the intention of doing my PhD in communications / signal processing. I think between the time that I graduated and the time that I landed in the United States, it was roughly around 9 months to a year. Within a year of my graduation from the university, with full intention to specialize in communication systems. My entry into devices was really somewhat accidental. When I started my Stanford tenure as a graduate student, you know, during the first, Stanford has a quarter system. So during the first quarter, I was deciding on what courses to take. And since I had never had a formal course in devices during my undergraduate days, you know, the courses I had were primarily in electronics, but they really treated the devices as a black box, you know, instead of doing it from the fundamental physics, looking at them from fundamental physics. I decided basically that it'll be a good idea for me to know something about how devices work. So I decided to take this course at Stanford, which is, they still have it, I think it's called EE216. It's a mezzanine level course offered by the Electrical Engineering Department. And it was at that time taught by an associate professor at Stanford, Jim Plummer. So I took that course during my first semester, first quarter. It was really that particular device class that was taught by Professor Plummer, which played a significant role in changing my direction later on towards specializing in semiconductor device physics and process instead of communication systems. At the end of the course, I really wanted to learn more about device physics. Jim Plummer was a superb teacher, and a very, very inspiring teacher who basically taught the concepts in very physical terms. he always carried a crystal structure of silicon with him to the class. I still remember that. And as a result of that, I think I decided that why don't I explore more advanced classes in device physics and process technologies at Stanford. And I kept on doing that. And finally, I decided to pursue device electronics for my PhD.
Thanks, Tahir. I actually like the thanks for also sharing what really attracted you toward electron devices. So I would like to make some comments for our audience, and you will I'm sure you will happily share them. So first of all, that your the initial I would say that the fascination for physics or is not from a perspective of from Pakistan shouldn't be a surprise, because I think Professor Abdus Salam, who is a Nobel laureate from Pakistan, he is a condensed matter physicist.
Yes, he was a particle physicist.
Okay, so we are aware of him. We know very much about him. So the next is what you shared, that this prolonged college life due to political reasons, I suffered quite a bit of that. Many of us have gone through that process, which actually killed a significant portion of our youth. That's how I would prescribe it now, being a middle-aged person. And obviously, Jim Plummer eventually became the dean, one of the towering figures in our field, a member of Academy of Engineering, and his book is well taught by in most of the colleges and as well as in the graduate classes. As you know, the VLSI technology as the primary book for the process technology. So we'll now actually go to the part where tell us a little bit about your PhD. Research work, your cohort, your advisor, relationship, the dynamics, everything.
Certainly. So I think between the time that I completed my master's and the time that I started my PhD, actually there was a certain diversion that perhaps I would like to share with you. So due to certain personal reasons, after completing my master's, I decided to pursue a job in the industry working for advanced micro devices, working initially in reliability department and then in the programmable logic device groups. And my intention was that I wanted to get that experience for a couple of years, which basically turned out to be, in the end, between 3 and 4 years before I decided to move back to Stanford for PhD on a full-time basis. So that was sort of a diversion. And in retrospect, I think, I believe that that was not a good idea. But in any case, I decided to move back full-time to Stanford. I decided at that time to join Professor Jim Gibbons' group at Stanford. Jim Gibbons actually was a legendary dean of engineering, and he was actually an active dean of engineering at that time. And he offered me to work on a new area, a very promising area at that time, having to do with strained silicon germanium heterojunction bipolar transistor project for my PhD thesis. Just for your listeners, these heterojunction bipolar transistors are promised to introduce the concept of a heterojunction, I believe for the first time in silicon technology, with the objective to dramatically improve the performance characteristics of bipolar transistor to achieve significantly higher switching speeds relative to the silicon bipolar transistors. And as you know, in those days, basically, the high-speed technology, both computers and communication, I'm talking about now late around 1990 timeframe, 1991, was based on bipolar technologies. And there used to be a technology called emitter-coupled logic, or ECL, which was exercised for really high-speed switching devices at the cost of high power. And heterojunction, this concept of silicon-silicon, germanium-silicon heterojunction bipolars promised significantly higher switching speeds while keeping the other characteristics relatively similar to silicon HP, silicon standard silicon bipolar transistors. So I thought it was a very exciting project at that time. It was new. It was a brand new project. And Jim Gibbons' group was known for innovative ideas at Stanford. And there was a student who had finished, there were actually a couple of students who had finished their PhD thesis at the time that I joined, or were about to finish their thesis, working with a new epitaxial tool called rapid thermal CVD-based epitaxy that was developed in-house at the university by Jim Plummer. Another, I think, extremely important aspect that I need to mention, that when I joined Jim's group, was that Jim himself was very, very busy with all the responsibilities he had as a dean. And the person who was really running his group on day-to-day basis played a significant role in my development as a device engineer. Her name is Judy Hoyt. Many of us know Judy. She has been a very active participant in IEEE and IEDM, and has been a professor in electrical engineering at MIT for, I think she joined somewhere in late 1990s. And, you know, it was basically, you know, I worked very closely with her, and she was a big role model for me, both in terms of understanding how to attack experimental areas, how to proceed and attack those areas in an effective manner. And also personally, you know, she was an excellent mentor and a role model in terms of what hard work and dedication is all about. You know, she would be there first person in the lab every morning before 7 o'clock, and typically be the last person out, you know, somewhere around 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So, and she was just an excellent mentor. And I really believe that I learned a lot under her tutelage. In the end, my PhD thesis dealt with the AC and DC characterization of these highly doped strained silicon germanium HPT transport physics, understanding that and extracting the key parameters out for strained silicon germanium, which were very useful in modeling and understanding the capabilities of silicon germanium HPTs. And it was primarily experimental in nature, where I fabricated these HPTs with the intention of teasing out these characteristics from experimental measurements. And that was the focus of my PhD thesis.
Great. Many, you know, your discussion about Judy as well as Jim Gibbons, like, you know, that will again highlight their accomplishments on their own merit. I want to actually focus on a point that you made at the beginning. You said that in retrospect, when you think about that, your detour to the industry to work on the reliability engineering for a few years, and after that, you rejoined the PhD program. That decision of detouring to the industry, you might actually reconsider today if you were the person. And many of these students today, you know, that they ask these questions that, well, you know, professor, I'm undecided whether I should go for an industrial experience or and then come back and continue in PhD, or I continue in PhD after my master's. Can you please elaborate a little bit, because this will be very helpful for that portion of the audience.
Yes, I think there were many other students also at Stanford who had industrial experience prior to joining PhD. So it was not really that uncommon. I think it is really a function of the type of job that you do during that time, and the experience that it brings with you, that experience that you carry with yourself as you join the PhD program, of whether that experience is helpful for you in basically towards either selecting or completing your PhD thesis. You know, many students basically who take a break and work for an industry find that it is very beneficial. It has been very beneficial for them because it helps them identify those projects which are meaningful to the industry that they may not have had if they would have directly gone from master's to PhD. And at the same time, basically, it enables them a certain sense of, it gives them a better sense of how to attack the problem and being more focused on solutions. During the PhD, the problems arise, you need to solve them, you need to move on. And many find it being very useful also from that standpoint, having had a work experience where they need to lead a more disciplined life. So I think it is, many, many students have found it helpful. For me personally, I did not find it helpful because of the type of work that I was doing during those years. I found that it did not help me in terms of either selecting or in terms of attacking my PhD during my PhD tenure. Many students find it, I would say majority of the students find that experience very helpful in selecting the thesis and completing their PhDs. So I would personally, based on not my experience, but overall what I have seen, I would encourage students to take a break for a year or two. I would certainly encourage them to do that. There were some other students who had decided to work as an intern, as a research intern at places like IBM, Yorktown Heights, or Bell Labs during those days. And many of those students, I think, found it extremely helpful to have had that research internship experience.
Okay, that's great. Like, you know, it also helps them to extend their network in addition to understanding, to find out a better project. So, I think like, you know, the couple of months back when you were giving a talk in Berkeley, when I was there, and I asked you this question, right? And I'm going to actually bring that back. So, you know, from your prolific experience in the industry and when we are in the university, right? So that university, we do have a little bit of luxury to pursue, the freewheeling ideas, right? Like, you know, that might not be useful right away for the industry at the moment, but that actually helps to nurture the creativity of, like, you know, the on many occasions. I was in the industry and I've seen, like, you know, that we are basically in a certain boundary conditions, we have to be creative to address the next challenge and to do something new. You are part of that. You have led high-k metal gate evolution of that. You have led transition to 3D non-planar transistors. So my question is that when you look these research topics in the universities today, And not all the universities have the right facilities even to catch up with the scaling trend and many other advanced technologies which are available in the industry today. What is going to be your perspective? The universities should focus more on industry-oriented research thesis, or they can pursue and they should pursue some freewheeling ideas, because they need to also have a rigorous academic program to train the students both theoretically as well as practically, so that when the transition point comes for them to join industry, they're, that the boots need to be on the ground from day one, right? So what is your perspective on this?
That's a very good question. I think my perspective is that, the reality is that even some of the best universities in the United States, the facilities that they have available in integrated circuit fabrication are nowhere close to what, some of these, the leaders in the industry have, either in the development or in research. I think the universities need to focus on fundamentals instead of industry-oriented project. I think it is very important that students get a good experience in understanding the fundamentals of semiconductor devices, the fundamentals of electron transport, the fundamentals of solid state theory, the fundamentals of process physics, and the fundamentals of device physics so the focus really needs to be more on fundamental understanding, which is extremely important in its own right. Universities will never be able to catch up with the industry, but what they have is, if they nurture basically creativity, if they nurture basically, creating an environment which is conducive to creativity and putting this zest in the students to learn the fundamental devices, the physics, the fundamental physics, then I think that is extremely important also from the standpoint that if the student has had good fundamental grounding, then basically they can work in very different areas, as they enter the university. If you have good understanding of electromagnetics, you have good understanding of quantum mechanics, you have good understanding of, fundamentals of condensed matter physics, semiconductor physics, process physics, process modeling, technology CAD modeling. Once you have good understanding of all these areas, then you can work on a range of projects and come up to speed very quickly, as against the option where you basically focus just like industry does, on a particular aspect of a problem, and then you become very limited in terms of your vision. Your vision becomes very, it's sort of a tunnel limited. It is very tunnel vision. And at the same time, you have less opportunity to come to basically look at adjacent areas, because the information that you have or the learning that you have had as part of your graduate program is very limited and not general enough for you to easily understand the adjacent areas. So, from standpoint of having a broad career over years, and we know that, things change a lot with time, and what is important today or what was important 30 years ago, the skill sets and the background that is needed to move forward in the next 20, 30 years is going to be very different. So people who are going to win in the long run are the people who have very solid background in terms of fundamental understanding. So universities need to focus on fundamental understanding instead of applied research to a particular type of problem.
I fully agree with you, Tahir. I think that this is a very comprehensive a response to a, I would say, a prime time question, specifically that the US government is trying to put together resources so that we have a very strong semiconductor technology, as well as like the specifically focusing on the manufacturing workforce in the next 10 years or so for our competitive advantage. It's kind of like, you know, the beating the own bush, like, you know, the Purdue actually offers the most of the courses that you're suggesting, and me joining there, putting together a very strong program on the manufacturing aspect, specifically the process physics and chemistry, combining the expertise in the different departments, materials, chemical engineering. Because as you can see that lithography is just not just a 2 weeks like in the module in the fundamentals of the semiconductor processes. Lithography is made up of the chemistry, the lithography tool, the optics, and many other different things, right? So it can actually be like, you know, that this is the right time. The age, in most of the cases for the students, is in their favor, as well as, like, you know, the this is the right time to actually you know, solidify their concept. And in the meanwhile, they also pursue a creative idea through their PhD research, because my experience in industry suggests that maybe, like, when I was trained in UT Austin, very well trained, I would say. Then when I went there, I never had any problem like switching from one process to integration to, like, you know, the to different generation nodes, the different architectures. I think that helped us a lot. Otherwise, I would have been occupied with a very narrow area that, okay, I have to keep working on that. Maybe at some point that becomes obsolete. We never know. Thank you so much for that. Okay, so let me ask you this question now. And this is actually, you have a long career span and a very successful one, and you have worked on different things. So if you're being asked, although this is kind of like the not, I would say that sometimes we don't find it a justifiable question, that if you have to pick one of the accomplishments of yours that you fondly, you know, the cherish, then please share with us on that one. I understand you might have parallel, you know, the likings, but let's talk about now here. Pick one and share a little bit of, like, on the how you came up with this, your work, as well as your teammates, like, you know, because you work in the industry, you led a team, you work with the people, and whether there was any eureka moment.
That's a good question, and it is a difficult question to decide exactly which project. You know, I've been really, really fortunate to have had the opportunity to join a technology development organization at Intel around mid-1990s, you know, at the right time, I believe, and work with, you know, work with this superb set of peers and my seniors in an environment really which created and which really nurtured creativity and teamwork, and you know, it really rewarded meritocracy, and so I really, really find myself to be very, very fortunate to you know, to work on all the projects that I have had the opportunity to work on over the last, I would say, almost three decades now at Intel. And as you know, basically, that it is not just a one person or a few person, it is basically the whole team and organization that has to work in harmony with each other to create a final technology which is, which meets all the criteria and is manufacturing ready. So, you know, some of the good ones that I carry in my mind that come to mind are initially our work in strained silicon, then it was high-k metal gate, then it was, after that was FinFET transistor, getting that to production. But if you want me to choose one, I think I will choose High K Metal Gate. I think that is possibly the fondest memories that I have. If I have to choose one during my almost, I think it'll be 28 years this year at Intel. And you know, the reason that I would choose that is that the conversion from polysilicon gate oxide to high K metal gate, I believe, was at the time the biggest change in the entire transistor fabrication for the last many decades. It was, you know, we basically changed the entire front-end transistor fabrication flow that was, you know, that was basically polysilicon and gate oxide, and patterned them first to basically high K metal gate last. So basically, that was a significant change in process flow and basically changed the very foundations of how the process flow was incrementally built built over time, you know, for the CMOS process in production at that time. Also, basically, it entailed implementing many, many new materials and integrating them into this new flow. You know, these new materials, whether it is high K or these are different form of metal gates, these were all really new materials, very unique constraints. And various new modules had to be built around them to enable their integration into the flow. And in terms of the implication, right, it was really getting to the very heart of the transistor, which is the very transistor channel. So, you know, prior to that, I think I had worked together with my colleagues on strained silicon, you know, which had its own challenges, but it was not touching the heart of the transistor itself. It was basically the source and drain regions. But here, when you go to high K metal gate, change the flow, introduce so many new materials all at one time with significant implications and change the very heart of the transistor itself, that was basically a significant challenge. You know, and there were challenges in terms of getting the performance out of what was expected or the capabilities of these new configuration of high K metal gate. There was questions of reliability challenges that were significant, of how to passivate the defects in high K. And on top of that, it was just like any technology where we would shrink the design rules. You know, we had to go from 65 nanometers to 45 nanometers back in the day when basically we introduced our high K metal gate technology. And it was all to be completed within a period of, you know, we would introduce a new technology every 2 years. And we did not delay the technology introduction. Just because it was difficult to accomplish so many tasks within a given time frame. And so I think if you look at the magnitude of change and its implication on the industry at large, I would definitely have to go with high K metal gate transistor technology as something that basically brings me the most pleasure.
Oh no, definitely, because you know the one of the founders, most prominent one, Gordon Moore, actually made this comment that this is the major fundamental change in the semiconductor industry in the last four decades. You know, I was doing my PhD. I did my PhD on high K metal gate for 45 nanometer node, pushing toward the non-planar transistor, and in the integration side. And I still remember, there were 450 plus different combinations of high K and metal gate were investigated by different organizations at that point, maintaining their thermal stability, like, you know, the work function pinning, the scaling related, the integration issues, all these things whether the hike will have a capping layer or not. So all these things, they were in play, including that his strain engineering was kind of diminishing from the contact edge stop layer, as well as the elevated source drain that continued. But there are so many different things were happening at the same time at such a fast pace. If you look at the, just from a publication side, the applied physics letters, that it was 50% of its every issue, the papers were dominated by the fact of a new high K or the reliability issue or something like that. That showed up and popped up, and all our conferences were there. So thanks for being one of the key players of that era. And that definitely is still being carried. That was definitely the most fundamental change. Okay, so now we will switch to a little bit lighthearted portion of our conversation, which is very popular specifically with our, the younger audience. So we call it the rapid fire round. We'll be asking you some questions. These questions are actually going to give us an access to you at a more personal level. You are encouraged to respond within with one or two words, but you can obviously elaborate. Whenever you're ready, I'll go ahead and we'll start this set of questioning.
Go ahead. I'm ready. Yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
My hobbies. That is interesting. I think at this time in my life, I would regard it as a hobby. I think I love collecting and reading excellent books on physics, and including the history of modern physics. Recently, for example, I finished a biography of a superb Indian astrophysicist, Subramanian Chandrasekhar. It was a very exciting biography. Over the last few months, whenever I get an opportunity, I'm rereading volume 3 of Feynman Lectures on Physics, which was the volume 3 is on quantum mechanics, and is a very unique way of introducing quantum mechanics to undergraduates for the first time. My hobbies are definitely the little time I have. I love to collect and read excellent books on physics, and especially I'm really interested in the history of the 20th century physics.
Okay, excellent. Music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
Oh, definitely. That's simple. Music. Absolutely. I like movies, but I love music.
Okay. Which is your favorite genre of music?
Oh, I basically have a pretty wide taste in music. For example, I love music from subcontinent, which ranges from, the typical good music from, say, Bollywood. And also a particular genre that I think people in subcontinent would be aware of, which is called ghazal. It's a typical genre of music in subcontinent. For English music, I also love a range starting with the popular music, like I love Beatles, I love Sinatra, Nat King Cole, classical. I love, really love Beethoven and Vivaldi, Strauss. So I really love music overall.
Okay, very good. So you already mentioned, what is the book you are reading now?
I am reading a book actually by a physicist whom I admire very much. He is an active physicist. He is a theoretical physicist who currently is on the faculty at MIT. His name is Frank Wilczek. And he has written some very good books. And I'm reading a book that he wrote about maybe around 6-7 years ago, that it's titled The Lightness of Being. That is the title of the book. It is an absolutely wonderful book. It's a popular book. It's, you know, in the sense that it is meant for popular reading. And it deals with, where all mass really comes from. And in the end, almost 99% of our mass comes from really pure energy. If you look at the atomic mass, most of the mass is, for example, in the nucleus. And if you look at the energy, or think of it as a potential energy which binds the nucleus together, they are bound by gluons, which do not have any rest mass. And if you look at it, E equals mc squared, or look at it in the form of m equals e over c squared, then you can see that all that energy that gluons have, although they don't have any rest mass themselves, since they are confined, most of the mass, what we call mass, is really the equivalent energy of those gluons. And what is typically, when people think of mass, a lot of the time people think of Higgs boson as something that endows mass to these elementary particles. But the reality is that most of the mass really comes from energy, and what we're weighing really is energy, which is from these potential energy due to these gluons, which holds the elementary particles together. So it's a very exciting book, that the way he has framed it, and he talks about that and the nature of empty space, and there is so much action that goes on in empty space, and when you put these all together, what does it mean in how we view this universe? It's a wonderfully, wonderfully written book so far.
Okay. Very unique perspective. My next question, what is your favorite cuisine?
My favorite cuisine, I would say, would be... I mostly have food from subcontinent. That's what I typically have at home. But if you ask me my favorite cuisine, I would say Japanese. It's light. I love sushi. I love tempura and some of the grilled stuff. I would say it would be Japanese, Far Eastern generally, but Japanese in specific.
Okay. Any sports you enjoy?
I used to be a very avid follower of cricket during as I was growing up in the environment. Cricket was the game that all kids basically played and followed, I just also millions of people in subcontinent love cricket and follow it actively, although these days I may not follow it as actively I would like, but I do basically watch key matches, especially when it comes time for the World Cup. And if I don't get a chance to see some key match, I would watch the recorded highlights. Without question, basically, it is cricket.
Okay. What is your favorite travel spot?
My favorite travel spot. I think I haven't done that much traveling, to tell you the truth. I have done, some amount of traveling with my family and as part of conferences, etc. Among the cities, actually, I really like London and New York. Due to their very international nature, and there's so much happening there, they're full of life. So I really like the environment in those two cities. I would like to go to see historical spots. I think that is one of my desire always, go and see historical spots. A few years ago, we went to, as a family, we visited Italy and went to various historical spots with regards to Roman Empire. And But you know, in terms of, you know, I have an upcoming sabbatical, and you know, places that I would really, really like to visit. One of them, I think, would be there would definitely be Israel. You know, there is just so much history out there in that piece of land, especially when it comes to religions of Abrahamic faith. And I would really, really like to go and visit there. And I think another place that I would really personally love to visit is Kashmir in India. You know, my entire family from my father's side is almost entire family, other than my parent, my father and one of his nephews who migrated from Kashmir to Pakistan in 1947. The remaining family is all in Kashmir, and I have never been to Kashmir. And that is something that I would really like to do sooner than later, to visit my family in Kashmir.
Right, Kashmir is known as one of the heavens on earth. So
yes,
we wish you the best. Hopefully you will be visiting both of the places. Okay, so now we are in the last part of our conversation. Here we will look into the future through your eyes. From that perspective, my first question is, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
You know, actually, you know, as I think it was Yogi Berra said that predictions are really, really hard, especially when it comes to future. you know, I think I will give you actually what I believe, at least which will cover the next 10 years or so, rather than long term, because my personal experience, you know, if you look at when I joined Intel in the mid-1990s, and if you know, if you would have asked me, for example, in the late 1990s, of where I see Moore's law and technology going, I would not have predicted, you know, the particular direction it has taken, and I would have definitely not predicted that we will be able to successfully scale and control nature at such a delicate level in something which is moving into high volume manufacturing. And here we are in 2022, you know, now we are in getting to Angstrom's regime, right? I mean, mind you, we are in single digit nanometers and getting into Angstrom's. And, you know, it is amazing that we are still talking about continuation of further scaling. You know, it points to the tremendous ingenuity and hard work and innovation of our device engineering community, that they have been able to carry it successfully over a period of so many decades, you know, and scale stuff to the extent that we now have to control many of these films that we deposit down to single monolayer. And no more. And it really basically, you know, and the thousands and thousands of people that who have worked in this field over a period of decades, who have certainly made these almost magic-like, you know, features move from curiosity to high-volume manufacturing. Absolutely remarkable. So now if you talk, if you basically... think about where we think we are going in the next 7 to 10 years. You know, I think certainly one of the very encouraging signs has been that the extreme ultraviolet or soft X-rays, this EUV as a patterning tool, has made it into high volume manufacturing. And, you know, the presence of this high volume of this tool combined with the expected improvements over time, you know, are going to basically will mean that these are not going to be the immediate limiters, patterning tighter and tighter feature sets. with 13.5 nanometers of wavelength as these tools improve their numerical aperture, etc. The many it'll be challenging, but I think I can see a road ahead in terms of being able to pattern those. There'll be many technology challenges around these films that will be needed and the control that will be needed to be as we go well into the Angstrom's era. So my belief is that if you look at over the next 7-10 years or so, I think the design rule scaling will continue. They will be patterning innovations with EUV lithography. The foundation of all of it, I believe, is going to be continuous introduction of new materials. These material innovations have been the cornerstone of continued scaling, and I think we will continue to see new materials introduced both in front end as well as in interconnects. For transistor scaling, I believe that everybody's talking about ribbon FETs or nanowires, and I think everybody is working on those, in getting manufacturable, in getting these new ribbon FET transistors manufacturing worthy. And I have no doubt that I think industry will be successful and introduce these ribbon FETs or nanowires, nanosheet transistors into high volume manufacturing within the next few years. And I think some of these will allow us to take gate lengths closer and closer to 10 nanometers physical gate lengths. Beyond that, I see, for example, that people are looking and publishing stacking these transistors on top of each other to continue scaling the cell height. These are called CFETs. There are many, there will be many challenges, but there is significant return, in achieving basically these three-dimensional self-aligned integration stacking these transistors. There is work going on active in two-dimensional channel materials, and I think those will be potentially the ultimate scaling enablers, which will enable basically superb short channel effect. Once the concerns that are there with these devices are addressed, I'm expecting that they will take our gate length to 8 nanometers and below 8 nanometers gate length. Coupled with that, basically, we will see an increasing role as far as scaling is concerned of DTCO. That role has already been going up in the last few nodes, and the DTCO stands for Design Technology Co-Optimization, where the idea is that you don't necessarily depend upon physical scaling, pattern scaling, but you really look at introducing new process features which facilitate scaling, right? That is basically design technology co-optimization. And we have done that previously when the industry introduced single diffusion breaks instead of double diffusion breaks between cells. When the industry introduced, contact on active gate, where the contact will go right on top of an active gate, which is being introduced and has been introduced by companies. Then there is self-aligned features that are being introduced. Then there is industry looking at the new power delivery schemes, which will enable overall shrinkage. So these DTCO components, I believe, are going to basically become a significant portion of overall scaling. On top of it, there is packaging innovations. You can see, for example, these remarkable new packaging innovations where you can dramatically improve the I/O densities and improve the delay or the latency couple these memories and other parts, different kinds of memories, I/Os, CPUs, GPUs. You basically make each one of these components making the best use of technology. It may not be the same node, and then put them together in a very compact form where basically you can achieve significant latency, you can achieve good latency, and at the same time you can put all of that in package so that overall system has a lot of very well integrated and scaled. So, you know, you put all these together, design rule scaling, transistor innovations that are actively being worked upon, the increasing role of innovations leading to DTCO or design technology co-optimization, and lately these packaging innovations. You put these all together, and I have no doubt basically that over the next 5 to 10 years, we will basically scale these barriers and use combination of these four factors in achieving really high density, high scaling, and unbelievable new application space that awaits us.
Great. I think it's a very detailed structuring of what we are expecting in the next 7 to 10 years. From there, my next question is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It can be technological, it can be non-technological, it doesn't matter.
I typically feel that I think we as a nation here in the United States need a stronger commitment by our federal government in spending on research in physical sciences and engineering. And it is spending on physical sciences and engineering, my belief is that it will be the key to ensuring future leadership of the United States. To ensure that United States remains the leader in technology and innovation. At this time, if I look at it and look at the disparity in budgets between, say, what is being given to medicine and the National Institute of Health versus what is being poured into physical sciences with all the budget cuts and engineering to universities and national labs. I am a strong proponent that, what history has taught us, recent history, that, there is a strong ROI and nations basically that are willing to invest in physical sciences and engineering reap their benefits multiple times over. And I think I would like our government, our federal government, to become more visionary and spend more, invest more by giving more to universities and national labs in research in physical sciences and engineering. And if we don't do that in the long run, I believe that it is going to have significant negative impact on United States' ability to stay a leader in this world.
Okay. There are just to actually there are two perspectives from a little bit different angle that this health related the expenditure that is in a sense attracting because of some constraint with the current resources, given to physical sciences engineering, that to think how engineering can actually be used for healthcare applications. And hopefully that will give more momentum and the emergence of new, the equipment as well as the personalized medicine and so on and so forth. As an example, MRI. Right, that kind of imaging technology is helping the millions of people all over the world. So hopefully that's one perspective. And the second, there is something about specifically in the United States that United States as a country of a diverse citizenship, that the people that mostly come from different corners of the world, right? So from a lifetime experience, that it's not only the hard cash those being used for research purpose through the academies, as well as incentivizing as much as possible, but not like many other countries who are now competing toe-to-toe with the industry also. The hope and the process of the raw talents coming into this country and then become worthy citizens and, like, you know, the you know, the contributing leaders and so on and so forth. That's a whole, like, you know, the life experience that in a sense that the whole country is providing an ecosystem with all its imperfections. So there is a lot more indirect, like, you know, the expenditure is happening. So I think, like, you know, the you and I both agree as citizens of this country that our tax monies are like, you know, well spent. Hopefully we'll have some opportunities to actually even choose where this needs to go, at least a portion of it. That might be a good start. Okay, so let me actually go to my next question. And this question is about what application would you like to see in the future that does not exist today?
Oh, I think, you know, I'm looking at actually, by future, I'm really looking at shorter term over the next, you know, 7 to 10 years, which is not quite existing in a finished, as a finished product, but the components are being worked on. So I think, one is the area of, you know, these supercomputers and exascale computing. You know, it is not a product that we directly as customers deal with, but those products are going to be very critical in terms of their impact on daily daily life of millions and billions of people. You know, with these exascale computing, I think we will be more able to do a lot of modeling and understand things better, which would mean that both in bio and non-bio areas, we will be able to have products and develop them at a rapid pace, things that we have not been able to do at the pace, at the rapid pace at this time. So I think I'm looking for products that basically integrate the new learnings and coupled with semiconductor technology improvements that incorporate artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks, and you know, a lot of these new products will generate a whole range of these new technologies will generate a whole range of new products, which are really hard to foresee. But another one that I'm basically very strongly expecting over the next 5 to 10 years, I think, is clearly the convergence of many of these technologies to create truly autonomous vehicles.
Great. Okay. My last question, and that is, what is your one piece of suggestion for the younger generation?
For the younger generation, is that right? For younger generation?
Yeah, younger generation.
For the next generation, a younger generation. You know, my suggestion and a piece of advice to the young generation is based on my belief that in 21st century, international, what we call as international leadership, it really requires the domination of STEM fields. And loss of STEM dominance will have a dramatic impact on the future living standards for the next generation. So my advice to them would be, number one, work hard. Pay more emphasis on understanding the concepts than having a singular focus on grades. That is very important, and to keep things in perspective and not to have focus on, not to have an overly strong focus on grades. Also learn to work well in a team environment. This is very critical because no man is an island on itself. And also being able to share your success with others and get delight and satisfaction in that sharing process. Lastly, basically, you know, to take failures, because failures is as much a part of life as success. Take failures in stride as a learning opportunity more than anything else. Learn from the failures go and take, you know, go and take informed risks in your life. Don't necessarily play it safe. That would be my advice.
Great, very well reasoned. Okay, so that concludes our formal conversation. And before I actually like to conclude our today's conversation, I have asked, was there anything that we didn't ask you, but you wanted to share with us?
Well, thank you so much, Mohammed. I really appreciate it. Appreciate your excellent interview. Very engaging, excellent questions, and really, really giving me an opportunity to share my views with you and others who will be listening to this podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.